A conversation with painter Jamie Wyeth. Jamie Wyeth comes from a remarkable line of American artists. He has referred to his family as the Flying Walendas of the art world. Jamie is the son of realist painter Andrew Wyeth and the grandson of the great illustrator N.C. Wyeth. Although Jamie's work is clearly influenced by his family, there is no mistaking his work for anyone else's, with paintings that are increasingly wild and dreamlike, and sometimes even menacing. Today, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston opens a comprehensive retrospective of Jamie Wyeth's work. Jamie joins me today to talk about his art, his technique, and his career. We'll discuss the iconic portrait he painted of President John F. Kennedy, the time he spent with Andy Warhol at the factory, and recent paintings depicting his mentor standing by a roaring ocean. Maine Calling finds out what inspires the American artist Jamie Wyeth. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A major new retrospective of artist Jamie Wyeth opens today at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. The exhibit spans six decades of Wyeth's work, portraits, landscapes, animal paintings, and new dreamscapes painted since the death of his father, Andrew Wyeth. We are very fortunate today to have Jamie Wyeth with us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Of course, we want you to be a part of today's conversation. What questions do you have for Jamie Wyeth? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet to @MaineCalling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Hi, Jamie. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Jennifer. Good to hear from you.
I wanted to start, Jamie, by saying that when I walked through the show last week, and now it wasn't completely up at that point, my first thought was, Jamie Wyeth must be so excited. And then my second thought was, maybe he's not. Maybe for an artist to have someone else, no matter how smart and talented, you know, cull through your life's work and make choices is very stressful. So are you excited or is it something else?
Well, it's a combination of both, but it is sort of stressful. And I actually find exhibitions of my work very painful because all the inadequacies in paintings that I've done years ago sort of jump out at me. So it's not a pleasant experience. I mean, certainly I'm honored to be at the MFA Boston, one of the great museums of the world, but it's also pretty scary.
All of the inadequacies, I find that hard to believe, but, you know, I'm not calling you a liar. I just look at that work and can't believe you're seeing inadequacies.
Well, I tell writer friends of mine, it's as if with their new novel, they're standing in a room and everybody's reading their new novel. And, you know, you feel kind of like a jerk standing there. I mean, you worry about how they're being received and so forth. So it's kind of stressful.
I wanted to talk to you about the iconic John F. Kennedy portrait that, of course, now the Museum of Fine Arts has acquired, but very recently was hanging in the vice president's residence. I understand that the Kennedy family commissioned you to paint that when you were 20 years old. Was that terrifying?
It was a bit sort of scary. I mean, I was swept up, as everybody else was, with the memory of this remarkable president and the mythic sort of dimensions of his life and so forth. So I actually, it was a commission from the White House, and which I turned down, and then went to the family and said, well, I'd like to attempt the portrait. And they hardly agreed and said, wonderful. And so I began this painting, very romantic vision of him. And then I felt the need to really work with a live Kennedy. So both brothers, Bob and Ted, of course, were living, and they said, well, follow us around, come to our hearings and come to the campaign trail with us. And I destroyed the first version. The Kennedys are brilliant, wonderful people, but they're tough, pragmatic politicians. And I had little of that in the painting, so I destroyed that. And then the present painting that you see is what I ended up with. And it caused a huge controversy at the time.
Yeah, I understand that Bobby didn't like it, but that Teddy loved it.
Yeah, and Jackie totally loved it. And Bobby felt it was sort of reminded him of his brother during the Bay of Pigs, and that he didn't feel was should be perpetrated and so forth. But that, you know, I took that as a compliment, that here was somebody, a man close to his brother, and the painting affected. It wasn't just another picture. So but it had a rocky kind of reception. Look magazine or Life magazine at the time did a full page fold out, and I got terrible letters from people saying, how could you do that to our martyred president with his blue-eyed, blonde-haired president, none of which he was. And now it's sort of turned around. It's now the national stamp of Ireland. It's sort of it's curious how paintings have a sort of life.
Do you think it's a change in the American consciousness? Have we become more sophisticated, or is it that people have lived with the painting a long time, or that Kennedy's legacy has changed?
Well, I think people have looked more at his legacy and his life, which has sort of been studied in depth, and I think they realized that he was not this sort of mythic hero. I mean, an extraordinary president, great potential, and so forth. And the painting is a real person who has obviously thoughts and misgivings and so forth. That's in the painting, and people didn't want to see that a few years after his death. And I was fascinated that Teddy and Jackie were so excited. She felt it was a side of Jack that few people saw. And so, you know, for a young person at my age at that point, it was an incredible experience.
I have heard that you painted John F. Kennedy's face over Teddy Kennedy's face. Is that true? Is that a true story? Well,
yeah, because I was so worried. Of course, I'd never met President Kennedy, and Jackie gave me all her photographs. The National Archives opened everything, and I sat and watched hours of films trying to establish a memory of him as if I'd been in a room with him for 15 minutes. And then I still felt I needed something live, so Teddy literally posed for the portrait, and then over top of that, I painted President Kennedy's sort of physiognomy.
Jamie, this was not the only incredible experience of your young life. You were a part of the factory. How did you come to know Andy Warhol?
Well, I'd met him through some mutual friends, some painter friends and so forth, and I immediately was fascinated by him. He was an extraordinary-looking creature with this white blonde wig and makeup and so forth. And so I asked him, you know, could I do some drawings of you? And he was fascinated by me being a painter and my family of painters, and so I moved to New York and spent about a year and a half working in his factory, which was quite an experience.
Who else was around the factory at the time you were there?
Oh, my God, you know, all the times, Mick Jagger, David Bowie, all these people wander in and out. And then, of course, a friend of mine, had just done a film called Pumping Iron, which starred Arnold Schwarzenegger, who barely spoke English at the time. And this friend brought him down and said, you got to paint the Mr. Universe. And so I said, fine. Well, of course, Warhol loved it. And here was Mr. Universe at the factory. You can imagine every queen in New York zeroed in on it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the Schwarzenegger painting is part of the retrospective, but also you have created, and tell me if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly, tableau vivants, which are sort of like perfectly scaled, would you even call them dollhouses, that depict what's going on, and they both depict that time in your life in which you were friends with Warhol. One of them is of the dining room in the factory. So clearly this is a moment in your life that you're thinking about even now in your 60s. As you look back at that time in your life, what is it that you remember most, and what still influences you?
Well, you know, painting to me, Jennifer, is sort of individual little worlds. I mean, I create a world in each painting that I do. And so I was carrying this a little further by actually making these figures, making these tableaus to sort of recreate a world in miniature. And I did them really totally for my own use. I never wanted to show them to anybody. I thought it was a little weird. Probably people would say, what is this? And I showed them to the curator of the exhibition, and she absolutely went crazy and said, oh, my God, these have to be in the exhibition. And I think now that they're in the exhibition, I think it brings another dimension, that painting can take all different forms. I mean, I sculpted all the little heads. I put the hair on Warhol and Nureyev. So, to me, it was just an extension of my paintings.
I'm going to guess that there's influence of Andy Warhol in your work. I see that when I see the portrait of the hay bale. But I want to ask you, from your perspective, did Andy Warhol influence your painting? And if so, how?
I think so, definitely, if you look at the work that I did shortly after that. And in a funny sense, I think I influenced Warhol. I mean, he was sort of interesting in that he drew from young people. After I spent my time there, then Jean-Michel Basquiat then spent time in the factory with Andy. And so he wanted to keep current, and my world of painting was so entirely different than his that he totally was intrigued with that. He'd come down to Chad's Ford, our farm in Pennsylvania, and he would spend most of the time watching television because he said it was better reception there. But he wanted to try these different worlds, and I was just intrigued by him. And if you take the whole body of his work, his books, his films, his paintings, I mean, he made a fascinating effort. And look at the relevancy of this painter today. Young people are just electrified by Andy Warhol.
I love that your portrait of him and his portrait of you are side by side in this retrospective. And I have to tell you, Jamie Wyatt, that he made you into a movie star and you did not make him. You did not do that for him.
Well, that's it. As I was working out, he kept telling me, oh, Jamie, you're using too much pimple paint for your my portrait and whatnot. But I mean, again, here was a man who, you know, most people, if I'd done a portrait like that, the deer in the headlights look, would have leapt up and said, I'm not going to pose for this. And he was fascinated and said, do it exactly as you want. And he was we were very close and had a wonderful time together.
Many of the drawings and paintings in the retrospective show of Rudolf Nureyev, there was also a show which I was lucky enough to talk to you about and meet you at the Farnsworth several years ago. What's interesting to me is that some of these are from 1977, but some from 2001. Why did you, well, maybe I'll start by asking how you met Rudolf Nureyev, why you chose him as someone to spend so much time doing portraits of, and then why you returned to this subject so many years later.
Well, I first, of course, had seen him perform and was just fascinated by this creature. And then, again, like Warhol, I met him at a friend's house, and in he swept, and here was the great Rudolf Nureyev, who had such a presence. And I spent an evening talking to him. At the end of the evening, I said, you know, could I do some drawings of you? And he said, of course not. I have no time. And swept out of the room. And in the ensuing year, then I and my father and grandfather had a show in the Soviet Union, which he read about and was fascinated. And so the next time I met him, he said, well, I'm here. I'm waiting for you to paint me. And so I began this portrait. But of all the people that I've ever painted, he was the most sort of demanding as to what I was doing. I mean, if I would do a drawing, let's say, of his foot or something, he'd look over and say, my foot more beautiful than that. And, you know, so it was terribly stressful for me. But I was completely attracted to his life and his intensity. And then when he sadly died, a number of the things that I wasn't able to do while he was living, I then went back to and sort of revisited him. And I'd done so many drawings of him, so many studies, I practically could draw him with my eyes shut. And so then I was able to sort of get deeper. And I think some of the best work came from really after his death. So it was rather curious.
I think my favorites of yours are your animal paintings. And it seems to me that you treat a portrait of an animal just as you treat a portrait of a person. Am I right?
Well, I do. I see no difference. I mean, I get just as excited about a bale of hay as I did of President John F. Kennedy. You know, again, as I say, my paintings are sort of obsessions. And each work I spend a lot, I destroy. But the ones that I do let be seen, I've spent an awful lot of time on. And whether it be a seagull or a Russian dancer.
Your seagulls are not the friendly seagulls that we're so used to seeing in paintings of the Maine coast. You don't view seagulls as a sweet creature, do you?
Well, I love seagulls because I live with them on this island. But, you know, most people have painted seagulls as if they're white doves. And if you really know seagulls, they are scavengers. They're villainous. I mean, they're cannibalistic. And I love that about them. And I wanted to show that in the paintings of them. So the extension of that, I dreamt one night, I don't know why, but the seven deadly sins. And I thought when I woke up the next morning, scattered on my bed were all these sort of drawings that I'd done sort of half awake. And then written on one of the sheets of paper was seven sins. And then I recalled that, oh, my God. And so I spent the next 2 years painting the seven deadly sins with seagulls.
I want you've told me this story before, but I want our audience to be able to hear it. Tell me the stories of how you got, the story about how you got ravens on Southern Island so that you could paint them.
Yes, that was, again, another obsession. I Ravens have always intrigued me through mythology and so forth, but they're a very sketchy bird. You can't get near them. And so I went to various ornithologists, and they said, well, wear the same color clothing, feed them same time every day. Well, I was covered with crows. I had them on my head, on my arms, but ravens wouldn't get near me. And so finally I went to, there's a wonderful biologist, ornithologist, writer named Bernd Heinrich, and he's written most books on ravens. So I contacted him. He came to the island, and after he looked rather like a raven, too. It was wonderful. Anyway, he said, well, to attract ravens, you need a cow. And I thought, well, a cow? Why would that attract ravens? Of course, what he meant was a carcass of a cow. So with that, I then, for the next week, went to various dairies in Maine, and finally a dairyman called me at 5 in the morning and said he had a stiff one, and over we went with a truck and my barge to my island, and Bernd Heinrich was right. The ravens came, and it took them a while to get through the hide of this, and the seagulls would scatter the minute the ravens arrived. And since then, I've had ravens on the island, so it sure worked.
And you had to barge that carcass to your island, correct?
Of course, yes. Yes. And of course, the unfortunate thing, it was a very warm spring.
Oh gosh.
And the wind started blowing southwest right into Tennis Harbor, and everybody started saying, what is that smell coming in?
Oh, my goodness.
So there were bad consequences.
Well, and of course, as part of this retrospective show is a giant painting of a raven, much, much larger than scale. Why make this painting so large? What was your thought process in painting this?
You know, I really don't know myself. That's where painting, and I hope young people tune into this. I mean, that's with painting, you can get so involved in things, and why I wanted to do a human scale raven is beyond me today, but at the time I was absolutely convinced that this is the way a raven should be painted. Shortly after I did the painting, I went to Alaska. They had an exhibition of my work in Anchorage, and the Inuits and Eskimos, a lot of them came to it, and of course they deify the raven in Alaska. Their forebears come back as ravens and so forth, so they of course thought I'd done the painting for them. And I had a fascinating exchange with them for a week up there talking about ravens. So, it takes you into all sorts of different worlds, the world of painting.
And we don't ask why for the subconscious. You know what? We have to take a break. Hate to do so, but when we come back, we will ask Jamie Wyeth more questions about the major retrospective of his work at the Museum of Fine Arts, and we'll take your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine's public universities. You can help make Maine even smarter and stronger. Learn more at think.maine.edu. And Casella, converting landfill gas to electricity, committed to providing clean, renewable energy for Mainers. Casella, giving resources new life.
On the next Fresh Air, Boko Haram, the Islamist militant group which kidnapped more than 260 girls from a school in northern Nigeria. We talk with Alex Perry, who wrote the Newsweek cover story about the group and has written a new book called The Hunt for Boko Haram. We'll talk about the group's founder, its current leader, and how it tries to justify the atrocities it's committed. Join us.
Tune in tonight at 7 o'clock for Fresh Air here on MPBN. MPBN is searching for a digital director to help MPBN meet the online, digital, and social media needs and expectations of MPBN radio, television, and online audiences into the future. This position is a senior-level position that will help strategize, develop, and guide MPBN's movement to a digital-first organization, ensuring MPBN's valued programs, journalism, and public service offerings meet their full online and digital potential. If this sounds like you or someone you know, and you have an appreciation and a passion for MPBN and the mission of public media in the digital age, please let us know. Visit our website, mpbn.net.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, artist Jamie Wyeth. The Museum of Fine Arts in Boston has just opened what it is calling the first comprehensive retrospective of the artist's work. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet to @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. We're going to take a call from Jennifer in Monmouth. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
I grew up seeing the Wyeth tradition. My grandmother showed me a lot of the paintings as a child. And as I grew up, my favorite painting was The Lighthouse by Mr. Wyeth. And I ended up getting it tattooed on my arm, actually. And it evokes a sense of mystery and wonder to me, but I've never heard the actual background story on the painting. And I was wondering if I could get some insight.
Now, you said The Lighthouse. Is this one of Jamie Wyeth's painting, or
yes,
one of his?
It's Jamie Wyeth's painting.
Jamie,
yes,
you're painting
is.
The Lighthouse. You've painted The Lighthouse. I'm a little confused because you've painted it more than once.
Well, there is a painting called The Lighthouse, and I think it's the one with the figure running towards it in red.
Yes, that's the one.
That's the one. And well, let me just tell you, I live in the lighthouse. That actually is my home. And as somebody said, living in a lighthouse is like running away with a circus. It's about the nearest you can get to the ocean. And to me, lighthouses represent mythical sort of, I mean, here's these spheres. They built these things out on these rocks, you know, exposed to the weather and so forth. So they've always attracted me like mad. And so I when I first moved from Manhegan Island to Southern Island, where this lighthouse lives, I just wanted to do a portrait of the lighthouse. And I'm thrilled that it's on your on you as a tattoo.
Yes, that and sea ice is the other one that I have, and they're my two favorites.
Oh, great. Well, hope I'll see them sometime.
Jennifer, I really appreciate you calling in. Thank you so much. Jamie, is that the first time someone's told you they've tattooed one of your paintings?
It actually is. An honor.
Yeah, it really. No kidding. We have a Twitter question. What is your favorite music while working?
You know, I'm fun. I love music, but I no more could have music playing while I work than the man in the moon. I just find it, I so enjoy music that it's distracting. And I, as a child, when I shared sort of a studio with my father, he would have booming away on the then record player, Sibelius and Rachmaninoff and whatnot. And unfortunately, the record player was in my half of the studio, the other than the room that I use. And I had to wear earplugs and whatnot. And he, of course, loved it. So, you know, people work under different circumstances. But I can't have music playing while I'm working.
I want to refer back to Jennifer's call. Our producer, Jonathan Smith, says he's going to put the picture, the lighthouse, on our Facebook page. So if people would like to see what Jennifer has tattooed on her and Jamie Wyeth's painting of his home, you can go to our Facebook page and find that. But you said that you shared a studio with your father as a boy. What was that like? Did you all talk while you were painting together? Did he advise you? Did you talk about his paintings? Or did you work silently side by side?
Well, it actually was in two separate rooms, so we pretty much had our own worlds. And actually, that's where I did the most of the work on the portrait of President Kennedy when I was poring over the drawings that I'd done Bobby and Teddy. And my father was in the other room, you know, painting whatever he was working on at the time. So it was wonderful. I was thrilled with it, except for the booming music.
So we're going to take another call. This is from Maureen. Maureen, are you on Campobello Island or
yes,
Cantabello?
I am.
Campobello Island.
Have you been here?
I have.
Isn't it fabulous?
It is.
Have you had tea with Eleanor yet?
I haven't had tea with Eleanor yet.
Well, the Roosevelt Museum now has free teas with Eleanor. Come up and have tea with Eleanor. It's wonderful.
Do you have a question for Jamie Wyeth?
I do. I certainly do. Jamie, your renown is certainly astounding. I do wonder, though, what portion of that success in your career you attribute to your family name?
I think the name certainly has given me access to various, Cape Kennedy, the Watergate trials, so forth, this and that. But in a way, it's also a hindrance. I mean, people constantly compare us and which, you know, if I'm going to be compared, I'd rather be compared to my father and grandfather. So it works both ways. But the important thing about painting to me, and I learned it very early, is doing it. Just leave all those considerations outside my studio door. I find painting very difficult. It's not easy for me. And so those other considerations, whether, you know, my father, grandfather, and the Wyeth legend, is really of no consequence when I work.
Maureen, thanks for your call. Jamie, I've heard you say this before, that you find painting very hard and very painful. So how do you look toward each day when you're involved in a work? Are you waking up with a sense of dread, a sense of excitement, or how do you get yourself in front of that canvas or piece of cardboard if you don't really like it sometimes?
Well, it's not always inspired, and I've always felt like a dancer or a pianist or whatnot that you have to do it every day and all day, and once in a while, the opiate to me of painting is when things finally click, when all of a sudden President Kennedy became alive on my canvas, or Nureyev became alive, or the pig that I was doing. That's the opiate, but it's not inspired every day, but you have to push yourself. And in painting, in that discipline, there's nobody standing over saying, do it. You don't have a team of people, you don't have an orchestra, you don't have directors and cutters and so forth. So it's in that sense, you've got to drive yourself, but it certainly it's not always inspired.
Do you believe you'll paint for the rest of your life?
Oh, for three lifetimes. And, you know, people come on to where I live on the island where you've been, Jennifer, and they say, oh, you must be running out of things to paint here. Well, I feel I could be there, you know, five lifetimes and still not scratch the surface. No, one here's a writer's block where a writer wakes up and can't write anymore. I hope it doesn't, but I can't even conceive it happening. My head is so jammed with things I'm working on that I can't see straight.
We have a question from our Facebook page from Carl. I suspect this is Carl Little. He writes, how did Wyeth's seagull paintings end up at Brigham Young University? One of those questions I have a feeling he knows the answer to.
Well, it's quite interesting because after they were first, when I finished them, they were shown at the Farnsworth in Rockland, and there was a wonderful man who lived in the area who was sort of the head Mormon. He was raised a Mormon. He came to me and said, these have to go to Utah. And I thought, what? Why Utah? Well, he was so insistent. The next thing I knew, I was heading to Utah with the paintings. The opening was at the state capitol, which is larger than our nation's capital. And then I started reading about Mormonism, and of course, the Mormons deify seagulls. They're the birds that save them. When Brigham Young took them west after Smith's death, they landed at the Salt Lake, and that winter practically starved to death. The next spring, they planted their meager seeds, hoping for harvest, and along came locust, and that was going to be the end of the demise of them, and then in came seagulls. So the Mormons, they thought I'd done the paintings for them. I mean, they were just thrilled that, you know, the state bird is a seagull in Utah.
That's so interesting because like the ravens in Alaska and the Native Americans, you did not paint the paintings with this intention, but
yes.
Other people found meaning in them that clearly delights you after.
Well, it thrills me, exactly. I mean, again, it's a case of what the profession of painting can take you into, and that's where I hope young people will see my exhibition and say, wow, this is a cool world. You know, I think I'm going to try painting. It opens all sorts of things. It's great.
Although a young person may see how old you were when you painted some of these paintings and be quite intimidated that you were you were painting at such a remarkable level when you were still a teenager. I mean, really.
Yeah, I mean, it was early, but I have a brother, an older brother, who certainly ate the same fried eggs and bacon I did and had no interest in painting whatsoever. Nikki then became an art dealer later, but so it wasn't, you know, everybody in the Wyeth family wasn't saying, you must paint. But, you know, the tools were there. We lived in my father's studio, so it would have seemed sort of unnatural for me not to paint. But that's all I've ever wanted to do. I left school in the sixth grade just to have time to paint. And you know, I'm kind of a boring person because I have no hobbies and all I do is paint.
I would disagree with this. For one, I know that you're a dog lover, so that I think spending time with a pack of terriers constitutes a hobby. You know, I'm looking at the Peter Ralston photograph of you and your father together, and you're both laughing. And I'm wondering what you would like people to know about your father that maybe they don't. Maybe they make some assumptions based on his paintings that he was a very serious and maybe even frightening person. Is that the Andrew Wyeth you remember?
Well, no. I mean, there certainly was a seriousness about him with his work and so forth. But no, he loved people. They have this thing that he was this sort of hermit and so forth, which he really wasn't. But and he was a hell of a lot of fun. And And his death was a huge loss to me because we, you know, we were completely honest critics of one another's work. And I trusted his sort of word, and he trusted mine. And so his death sort of course, ended that. But the wonderful thing about the death of a painter is, that, you know, he lives on. And his work, I've surrounded myself with his work. And when I'm at any museum, I seek out Andrew Wyeth paintings. And I went the other day to the Museum of Modern Art, and here they had Christina's World, and they hang it, you know, sort of in a hallway. And the guard there, I sort of chatted with the guard, and he said, you know, the two most asked questions in the Museum of Modern Art is, where is the men's room? And the other one is, where's Christina's World?
That must have, I might have had my eyes fill up with tears at that one. The paintings that are the most recent paintings of yours in this exhibit are paintings that include your father. Would you describe these as dreamscapes? They're why don't you describe them instead of having me do that?
Well, they were dreams. Shortly after he died, I was out on Manhegan Island, and I'm not a great dreamer, or I hadn't been in my past. And I had this incredibly vivid dream of walking out on a very windy, stormy day in Manhegan out to the cliffs. And as I was watching the sea, I looked, and there were figures standing down near the surf. And as I got nearer, I realized, oh my God, it's one was Warhol, was standing sort of in the trees, and there was Winslow Homer, who I, of course, worshipped. And then the two other figures were my father and grandfather. So it was so vivid in my mind that I not only did one, I did two, I did three, I did four versions of the painting. Each version eliminated a figure. Warhol disappeared, Homer disappeared, and it finally ended up with just my father and grandfather.
Mm. Going to Elaine in Bangor. Hi, Elaine. Do you have a question for Jamie Wyeth?
Hi. Yes, thanks for taking my call. I want to say first that I love the work of your father and the illustrations of your grandfather, but your paintings are my favorite, and I've admired them many times at Farnsworth in Rockland. And I just, this may be a naive question, but when someone, you know, like yourself has honed their craft and can paint so beautifully in a realistic way, why is it that today's contemporary art scene celebrates the likes of, like, Damien Hirst with his shark and formaldehyde? And, you know, why isn't realism as celebrated in the contemporary art scene? And I'm going to get off and thank you.
Well, great, Elaine. Well, you know, that again, art is an individual thing, and people view things, oddly enough, a lot of the paintings, the excitement in paintings that I see, some of them are abstract. I mean, the danger with realism, it can be very prosaic, and particularly in the state of Maine, which is so emblematic and whatnot. I've always felt that Maine has produced more bad art probably than any state in the nation, a lot of it including my work. But I mean, and so, you know, at least with abstract and with free-form painting and so forth, you get away from that, and there's innate excitement. And so good realism should, I always say, a painting of mine or anybody's, you turn it upside down, you ought to be as excited in the painting as it is, and not sort of saying, oh, look, that looks like a real house or that looks like a real dog. And so there's things for me to learn from abstract and expressionist painting.
And I would say, and tell me if I'm wrong, that your paintings do have many abstract elements, especially these very recent ones.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, I hope so. And I think the excitement in painting is not just what is in there, what's painted, but the whole form of it, the whole shape of things. I mean, that's why I paint. I mean, I want to record these things, and I want to record them in the most exciting way. And so, you know, that's why I don't work from photography. I find photography, you know, why you're sort of looking through the lens of another instrument. I mean, I think painting should be interpretive. It's your interpretation of your emotions towards something, a person, an object, an animal, and out of it comes this record. And I have this this amazing urge to record things, and it keeps me awake at night.
It's curious to me that, or really interesting to me that you don't work from a photograph. And, you know, I know that when the camera was invented, a lot of people said about painting, well, painting will fall by the wayside, and especially portraits will fall by the wayside. But clearly that has not been the case. And your portrait of John F. Kennedy says so much more than any single photograph does. What is it that you're trying to achieve in a portrait that a photographic portrait would not achieve?
Well, I think in a photograph, and I love some photographs, but it's an instant, it's a click, it's a moment in time. A painting, to me at least, is a distillation of the moods, the light, the sense of the person. It's really sort of a distillation down to one sort of image, and I think so it combines all the sort of thing. It's not just click. It's not just a one-second thing. And that's why I'm a painter and not a photographer.
The phone number is 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your questions for artist Jamie Wyeth. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Hospice of Southern Maine. Calling Hospice doesn't mean you're giving up. It means you're taking charge. Learn more at hospiceofsouthernmaine.org. By Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, committed to canning their entire line to protect the beer and the environment. BaxterBrewing.com. And Dean Wealth Advisors, independent investment advice to individuals, families, and institutions. DEIGHAN.com.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, we broadcast a conversation on extreme weather and the science of superstorms. Our guest, Heidi Cullen, is chief climatologist for Climate Central. Join me next time for a conversation with Heidi Cullen on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
That's coming up in just 20 minutes here on MPBN. News.mpbn.net. If you haven't yet visited, please check it out. All the news you need from MPBN and NPR with a clean look and a great mobile experience. From your trusted public radio station, it's the online resource, which provides you with an in-depth coverage of the most important stories taking place in Maine and beyond. News.mpbn.net. Easy to explore, mobile-friendly, wherever and whenever you want.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, artist Jamie Wyeth. We invite you to join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Jamie, we have an email from Jennifer. She writes, "My husband and I love the portrait of the Maine coon cats that is hanging in the Farnsworth Museum in Rockland. We purchased one of the prints to celebrate our 25th anniversary. Can you tell us a little bit about how you painted it?"
Well, it was painted on Monhegan Island, and there are a lot of coon cats on Monhegan Island, and so I got sort of excited. Don't ask me why, but I then went around and I sort of started asking people, "How can I really get these cats to pose?" And they said, "Well, what you need is what's the stuff? Something that attracts cats. There's some herb, but anyway, I was catnip, and so I got catnip. Well, I don't know if you've ever seen a cat with catnip. Some sort of ignore it. Others go completely crazy. So by the end of my work in this painting, I had all the island cats down at my studio, lines scratching the door, trying to get in. I was still in my studio. I was there the other day, and I still can smell the catnip. So that was the method of doing the picture.
Well, Jennifer, thanks for your question. We're going to go to Allison in Bristol. Hi, Allison.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment. Am I right in thinking that you illustrated a book called Cabbages and Kings years ago?
Yes, I did. My grandfather, of course, was a big illustrator, and then I did a book with my mother called The Stray, and then a writer came to me. I then was sent a lot of manuscripts, and I'm really not much of an illustrator, but that along came this book and intrigued the hell out of me, and so I spent a year working on it. And
My oldest child just turned 18 recently and graduated from high school, and she grew up with my reading that book to her very often. And in her senior year of high school, she really got into her pottery work and entered a teapot competition. And when she brought the teapot home that won, I don't know, most creative or something, it was this large, leafy cabbage teapot. And I said, "That is the cabbage in Cabbages and Kings." And she said, "Oh, you're right. I forgot about that." And those images just stayed with this child of mine through all these years. And it was really wonderful to see that the echo of that coming out in her own work. And I just want to thank you for doing that.
Well, you're welcome. That's a wonderful story. I love it.
That's a great story. Allison, if you have a picture of the teapot, please post it on our Facebook page. We'd love to see it. Jamie, it must be so gratifying to hear the different ways in which your work has influenced people, you know, buying a print for your 25th anniversary or influencing a young artist. I bet it never gets old.
Well, it's a little daunting, too. I try not to think of it when I'm working. And as I told you, I destroy a lot of my work because I just don't want... I'm old enough to see my father would groan when he would see at Sotheby's or Christie's a Christmas card that he painted for somebody coming up for sale, selling for hundreds of thousands. So I a lot of my stuff I get rid of. But what I'm more interested in is the act of doing it. And to have a response, yes, is gratifying, but I learned at a young age to sort of best to let the paintings speak for themselves. And sometimes these owners of paintings have a completely a different idea of what the painting's about, and I kind of like that and don't sort of impose my views on them.
Going to Jamie in Brunswick. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. I'm calling because I worked for an artist in New York for 2 years as an assistant, and I realized when I moved there that a lot of current-day contemporary artists utilize assistants. So almost seems like it's a necessary thing for demand, and I was curious to know if Jamie uses assistants and what he thinks of that practice.
I know some painters that do use this. I personally don't. I mean, I find painting is a very individual discipline. I mean, to me, you know, what is it? It's a piece of cloth and a stick with some hair on the end of it and some gooey stuff called paint. And again, you need no support system, no editors, no publishers, and so forth. And I've done prints, etchings, and lithographs, and of course you need assistance there, and that just bothered the hell out of me. I didn't much like it, but you know, Warhol had many assistants, and Jeff Koons, certainly most of his work he doesn't even touch. So you know, they're different forms, but I personally don't.
Thanks, Jamie, for your call. Going to Betty in Auburn. Hi, Betty.
This has been quite some time ago. I believe it was in the 1970s when shopping malls were brand new. We actually met in the Galleria in Houston, Texas. And we had a wonderful conversation about traveling and how different places can be. And I don't remember the paintings of your exhibit, but I just remember what a beautiful man you were and the wonderful conversation we had.
The gallery.
Well, great,
there was an exhibit in the big shopping mall, the Galleria?
In the Galleria in Houston, back when the Galleria was only the second shopping mall in the country, first after one in Los Angeles.
Wow. That's a reflection of our culture, yeah.
I remember that. And, you know, I rarely travel, but I occasionally travel when there's an exhibition of mine, and that must have been one of the cases. So nice to hear from you again.
Yeah, that was so much fun. We talked about how different places can be and how inspiring it was to travel and to throw yourself into different environments. But anyway, that was, I just remember that conversation over all these many years, and here I am talking to you again. This is the coolest thing ever. Thank you.
Well, Betty,
that's
thanks
great.
For
nice
your
talking.
Call. Great. Going to Christina in Portland. Hi, Christina.
Hi. I am a minister, and 2 years ago I went to the Farnsworth and saw your work, Jamie, and I bought book Seven Deadly Sins, and it was inspirational for me in preaching a series of sermons on the seven deadly sins. I just wanted to let you know that you were part of your work was part of my sermon theory.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, you know, oddly enough, but my trip to Utah with the paintings, I mean, the relevancy they felt of them, and they had a forum where they had 2,500 students asking me questions. It actually was Brigham Young University. And it was all about, why was I attracted to the sins? What is the relevancy today of these? And the fact that there was even a dialogue showed there is a relevancy. So I'm thrilled that this helped you in your work.
Christina, thanks for calling. Headed to Gorham and Andrew. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Hi, Jamie. How are you?
How are you?
Good. My father, David Coffin, used to play Cowboys and Indians with you, actually, down on the farm in Chatsford a long, long time ago. our family were whalers. Originally from Nantucket, but also had family up north, up in northern Maine on the coast. And we always had pictures of your father's paintings in our home, because obviously we have a close lineage to the sea. And I guess I just wanted to say how grateful I am to talk with you. And my father always kind of talks about the story. But also, living on Monhegan and being by the ocean, I obviously feel this kind of magical draw that's in my blood. And, you know, how does that relate to you in terms of your painting and just your joy of life being there on the island?
Well, it's obviously an integral part of me, and it certainly is in your family. My gosh, the Coffins sort of invented whaling, and I have a great friend who I hadn't seen for years, a man named Ed Coffin, who's about 93. He taught me to sail, and, you know, I'm sure, Jennifer, you're aware, the Coffin family, I mean, Tuckernuck Island off of Nantucket was their island, and so the sea is running through your blood, and I don't have that lineage, but certainly the sea runs through my mind constantly, and I long to get back to my island tomorrow. So great to hear from another Coffin family member. Good luck. Wonderful.
Thanks for calling, Andrew. We have Michael in Arundel. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. Yeah, Jamie, wow. It's such a pleasure to talk to you on the phone. I've been a fan of your father's since I was a child. I'm a watercolor artist also, but I make my living as a delivering the mail. But I was wondering, you know, maybe some story you could tell about a favorite story of your father's and you having time together. And you're just an inspiration.
Oh, well, I appreciate that and whatnot. Well, there's so many stories of my father and I together. Oddly enough, the only time we really worked on a painting together, my wife Phyllis was involved in raising oysters and whatnot, and so she asked would we design sort of a label, and so the two of us, my father came to the studio and we sat and he did the shell and I did the oyster in it, then he did the knife and I did the lemon, and we had a great time. And then other times with him I'd pose for him. And he'd be, of course, the one doing the painting. And, you know, the great misconception of Andrew Wyeth is, you know, they probably started on one side of the paper and worked across. He was a wild painter. Paint flew, brushes flew. I mean, it was just a miracle. Anything came out of it. And, of course, that's what I think saves his work. And all the people that sort of copy his work miss that point. He always said they always bring out the worst qualities to imitate my work. But thanks for the call and good talking to you.
Well, we have a video of a film that is, the MFA provided it to us, but it was which is the painting on Monhegan.
Inferno, yeah,
that's right. Would you say that your painting style is like your father's, that you can kind of get wild with the canvas?
Yeah, you know, that film was a revelation to me. Filmmaker Darcy Morris, whose films I admired, came to me, he was a friend, and said, could I just bring a camera into your studio? And I never allowed anybody in my studio. But Darcy's one of these quiet people, and I was nearing the end of working on this painting that I'd been so involved with and for weeks, and I totally forgot he was there. When I saw the footage later, I thought, my God, the amount of paint I stick in my mouth and the amount of sort of squinting, and I was amazed how physical I was. I wasn't aware of it. You know, I get completely lost in what I'm doing and was completely unaware I did all those strange sort of movements.
So when you watched yourself, was it like watching your father, or are you guys, was it in a different way, wild in a different way?
No, very much. And I think, as with my father, you know, whatever tool is nearby, I have hardly used a brush. I mean, I use the opposite end of a brush. I pick up things from the floor, scratch with things. In the film, you'll see I use a hair dryer to dry a portion of the paint. It's sort of a wild kind of act going on. But having said that, I think that, and particularly with my father's work, that's what saves it from just being dull realism, you know, just dull. Well, it could be a photograph. There's an innate excitement, and I think people sense that when they see the work, I hope.
I don't think anyone would call your seagull paintings dull, or any of the paintings for that matter. Is it Petria? Is that your name?
Yes, it is.
Petria and Brooks, go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Wyeth, you're one of my favorite artists, and my favorite piece is the three dogs coming out of the water, but that's not why I'm calling. My favorite thing that you have, you and your wife, is that beautiful thoroughbred horse. It raises the flag or American flag, whatever it is, I can't remember.
Union rags, yes.
Union, and he's 16'3", and he's the most beautiful animal, and he has the kindest expression in his eyes. I'd throw my three-year-old granddaughter on his back in a heartbeat. Just a nice-looking animal. You must be so pleased with yourself.
Oh, he was a great horse. And the wonderful thing, the amazing story of that is he was raised on our farm. And I would look out of my studio, and there would be the young colt Union Rags running around. And to have him eventually grow up and win the Belmont Stakes was really phenomenal. And he is, you're right, he's a very sweet horse. He's a giant horse. And I think a lot of his calmness is the fact that he grew up on the farm with all my pigs and various animals that I use as models. So nothing, we have a train track that goes right through the middle of the farm. That doesn't bother him. So he was cool as a cucumber at the Belmont.
Well, Petria, thank you for your call. And unfortunately, that's the last call. We're out of time. Jamie Wyeth, thank you so much for joining us today on Maine Calling. A major retrospective of Jamie Wyeth's work opened today at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Charlotte Ruddy answered your calls. And we had additional help from John Bradford as well as from the MPBN web team. Tomorrow on the program, keeping your children engaged, entertained, and maybe even educated this summer, join me for a conversation about some of the fun and interesting things to do with your kids as we enter the dog days of summer. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on MPBN.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Orthopedic Institute at Mercy's Four River, dedicated to getting you back in top form. The story of quality and value continues. And Shaheen and Gordon, providing a full range of legal services to businesses and individuals, with offices in Saco and Dover. ShaheenGordon.com.